stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is a so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jizan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes in Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, I mean, Yemen should stand strong. The international community, the anti-imperialist international community, should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed the blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, The opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's while Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should step down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture, and I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these, and they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its Western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that Western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions, Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were getting one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, childbearing. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of childbearing in the Islamic lifestyle. There is a lot of emphasis on having more children in the Islamic texts and in the Islamic teachings, whereas the Prophet has said that you need to bring more kids, or we need to have more children. And if you want to choose someone as a spouse, one of the criterias should be that whether they will be able to bring kids or not, or children or not. And that is one of the conditions. They said when you want to marry, like a girl to a boy or boy to a girl, they should see that whether they can bring kids or not. And that's why Imam has said, we have a narration from Imam Baqir alayhi salam as well, that when you marry to someone who can bring kids, and do not go after the beauty only, and the beauty who denies to have kids. Why? Because they're not expanding the human generation. They're not being the cause of the expansion of the human generations. And this is what Imam is saying, that you need to be careful when you need to marry. So in Islam, there is a lot of emphasis on marrying. Obviously, you cannot have kids according to the Islamic teachings legally if you're not marrying. Therefore, there is a lot of emphasis on the marriage and after marriage on having kids. And it is also said that do not think that you should not have kids because of your financial issues, because financial issues has nothing to do with the kids, because Allah has given the promise of sustenance, or providing the sustenance. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of childbearing, and we said that many people, they don't bring children or they don't bring kids because they think that they cannot provide their sustenance. They are maybe through like the means that they have, for example, like financially they cannot support. Some people think they cannot train their kids, and that is one of the reasons of not bringing children. Or maybe they think like they need to enjoy their life for some time, and after that they think about the formation of the family, whereas all these things are not right. The enjoyment in the life is with the kids. The family formation is the bound through which you will have more sustenance, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has promised to give us the sustenance. So even it is also said that when you have a kid, when we have a kid, when a child is born, Allah increases the person's sustenance because He has promised. Yes, we need to struggle, and on top of that, Allah will give us the sustenance. He will provide us. And because He has promised us for this sustenance, therefore, we should not be worried about it. We only should worry about the amount of work that we are doing or the struggle that we are doing. Therefore, Islam emphasizes, and according to the Islamic lifestyle, having more kids means having a better life and the happiest life. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. Most Americans believe that most politicians are corrupt. How depressing. Not to mention how terrible for the health of democracy. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. It has been written by Michelle Cottle, a member of the paper's editorial board. The piece is titled, Congress Can Trade Stocks or Keep the Public Trust. Not both. Most Americans believe that most politicians are corrupt. How depressing. Not to mention how terrible for the health of democracy. After all, if the system is broken and everyone is a crook anyway, why not elect a reality TV grifter with a smashed ethical compass to be president? Sensitive to this problem, Congress typically responds to scandals within its ranks with fits of reform fever. This is what we are now seeing with bills, so many bills, aimed at restricting lawmakers from trading stock while in office. The issue of how to prevent members of Congress from improperly profiting from their positions has long been a tricky one. Lawmakers have access to information unavailable to the general public and the power to shape policy in a direction that could prove personally lucrative. In 2012, Congress passed the Stock Act, which prohibits members of Congress from making trades based on their privileged information. Progressives, such as Senator Elizabeth Warren, have been arguing for years that much more needs to be done. The issue grabbed renewed attention in the past 2 years after questions arose about whether certain lawmakers made stock trades based on their privileged knowledge about the COVID pandemic. Senator Richard Burr, a North Carolina Republican, has earned himself extra close attention from the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, for dumping a bunch of stocks in the hospitality industry in February of 2020. Last month, an investigation by Insider revealed that dozens of members of Congress had violated the reporting requirements on trading. The report also found that Congress tends to be lax about punishing violators and about making information on this matter public. Policing its own has never been the institution's strong suit. Just like that, congressional stock trading became a hot topic again. Lawmakers from both parties are rushing to offer up their solutions, some more stringent than others. Punchbowl News did a roundup last week of early contenders, with more expected. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Representative Raja Krishnamurti of Illinois, both Democrats, are championing a bill that would bar lawmakers and senior staff members from trading individual stocks and require that they place all stocks in a blind trust. Senator Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, would require lawmakers and their spouses to use a blind trust and compel lawmakers to return any stock profits to the Treasury Department. Democratic Senators John Ossoff of Georgia and Mark Kelly of Arizona would extend the trust requirement even further, to include lawmakers' dependent children, as would a bill by Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Virginia Democrat. Details aside, it is hard to say whether this issue will receive serious consideration in either chamber. The Democratic majority already has a lot on its plate. It's an election year. Partisan posturing will be in full bloom, and currently, and rather awkwardly, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opposes major reform. The Speaker believes that sunlight is the best disinfectant, explained Drew Hamill, her Deputy Chief of Staff, noting that she has asked Representative Zoe Lofgren, who chairs the Committee on House Administration, to examine members' unacceptable non-compliance with the reporting requirements and consider the possibility of stiffening penalties. But on the matter of whether to restrict trading by lawmakers, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi is decidedly not on board. Asked about the issue last month, she snapped down the idea. "We are a free market economy. They should be able to participate in that." This is indeed a free market economy. It is also one that a growing number of Americans feel is not working for them. Combine that with the public's aforementioned grim view of politicians, and you can see where Nancy Pelosi's remarks might be considered a wee bit out of touch. House Democrats would do well to work on changing their chief's mind, not just because it is the right thing to do, but also because the party risks being outflanked by Republicans on the issue. Make no mistake, GOP leaders know a political opening when they see one. Last week, the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said he would consider limiting or banning stock trading by members if his party wins control of the House of Representatives in November. See what he did there? You can bet this issue will pop up again and again as the midterm elections heat up. Democrats need to put themselves in a position to own that debate. Even lawmakers who hew to the straight and narrow understand that America is facing a crisis of faith in its political system and in its elected leaders. lawmakers can obsess about making money once they leave office. Until then, they need to stay focused on the public interest, which includes taking steps to reassure the public that they aren't all a bunch of corrupt, self-serving, money-grubbing, power-hungry crooks.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
کار رو برای خدا میکرد، تظاهر نداشت، لافزنی نداشت. خدای متعال اولین پاداش دنیایی که به این اخلاص او داد همین تشییع 10 میلیونی بود.
He would work because of God and he was free of pretentious behavior and boasting. The first worldly reward that God the exalted bestowed on him for his sincerity after his being killed was his burial ceremony in which tens of millions of people participated. That burial ceremony was his first worldly reward for his sincerity and of course there is his reward in the hereafter. The popularity of Shahid Soleimani's name, personality and memory was his worldly reward. After the past 2 years, Martyr Soleimani's name has been repeated and written by various individuals thousands and thousands of times. This year too, people themselves have organized commemoration ceremonies for him. But as I said, I will get to this topic. These are due to the sincerity of that dear Shaheed.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
شهید سلیمانی الگو شد. یکی از حقایق بسیار برجسته اینه که شهید سلیمانی تبدیل شد به یک الگو.
شهید سلیمانی became a role model. An outstanding reality is that Shahid Soleimani has become a role model. Today, many of the youth in the Islamic world, and particularly in the region, the information that I have is related to the region, are thirsty for the emergence of heroes such as Shahid Soleimani. They are thirsty for such heroes. The more the memory of Shahid Soleimani is promoted, the thirstier and more enthusiastic they become for the presence of such heroes in their own countries. In our region today, Martyr Soleimani is a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. He is the secret to resistance and victory. These things are in the hands of God, not in the hands of anyone else. The likes of people such as us cannot accomplish such things, no matter what strategy we use. Such things are done by God Himself.
جریان ضد استکباری در منطقه، جریان مقاومت در منطقه امروز از دو سال پیش پر رونق‌تر و شادابتر و امیدوارتر داره حرکت میکنه و کار میکنه.
The anti-arrogance movement and the resistance movement in the region are moving forward in a stronger, more dynamic and more hopeful way than 2 years ago. In Syria, the enemies are faced with a dead end. The enemies in Syria have no hope for the future. These are blessings from that dear innocent blood.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Limelight. America's largest oil firm, ExxonMobil, claims its history of publicly denying the climate crisis is protected by the First Amendment. We now present you an article written by Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, How Exxon is Using an Unusual Law to Intimidate Critics Over Its Climate Denial. ExxonMobil is attempting to use an unusual Texas law to target and intimidate its critics, claiming that lawsuits against the company over its long history of downplaying and denying the climate crisis violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantees of free speech. The U.S.'s largest oil firm is asking the Texas Supreme Court to allow it to use the law, known as Rule 202, to pursue legal action against more than a dozen California municipal officials. ExxonMobil claims that in filing lawsuits against the company over its role in the climate crisis, the officials are orchestrating a conspiracy against the firm's First Amendment rights. The oil giant also makes the curious claim that legal action in the California courts is an infringement of the sovereignty of Texas, where the company is headquartered. 8 California cities and counties have accused ExxonMobil and other oil firms of breaking state laws by misrepresenting and burying evidence, including from its own scientists, of the threat posed by rising temperatures. The municipalities are seeking billions of dollars in compensation for damage caused by wildfires, flooding, and other extreme weather events, and to meet the cost of building new infrastructure to prepare for the consequences of rising global temperatures. Rule 202, in effect, allows corporations to go on a fishing expedition for incriminating evidence. They're able to question individuals under oath and demand access to documents even before any legal action is filed against them. ExxonMobil wants to use the provision to force the California officials to travel to Texas to be questioned by the firm's lawyers about what the company describes as lawfare, the misuse of the legal system for political ends. ExxonMobil claims in a petition to the Texas Supreme Court that it is entitled to question the officials in order to collect evidence of potential violations of ExxonMobil's rights in Texas to exercise its First Amendment privileges to say what it likes about climate science. The company claims in its petition the potential defendants' lawfare is aimed at chilling the speech of not just ExxonMobil, but of other prominent members of the Texas energy sector on issues of public debate, in this case, climate change. The oil giant's critics say ExxonMobil's attempt to use claims of free speech to curtail the First Amendment rights of others follows a pattern of harassment towards those who challenge the company's claims about the climate crisis. Patrick Parenteau, a law professor and former director of the Environmental Law Center at Vermont Law School, has described the company's move as intimidation, intended to make it cost a lot and be painful to take on ExxonMobil, whether or not the company wins its case. In a highly unusual move, Texas's Governor Greg Abbott has written to the all-Republican court, half of whose members he appointed, in support of ExxonMobil. He accused the California litigants of attempting to suppress the speech of 18 Texas-based energy companies on the subject of climate and energy policies. Greg Abbott wrote, "When out-of-state officials try to project their power across our border, as respondents have done by broadly targeting the speech of an industry crucial to Texas, they cannot use personal jurisdiction to scamper out of our courts and retreat across state lines." In backing its claim, ExxonMobil's petition to the Texas Supreme Court gives the example of the Oakland City attorney Barbara Parker, who in 2017 issued a press release seeking to stifle the speech of the Texas energy sector, or, as she likes to refer to it, Big Oil. The press release said, "It is past time to debate or question the reality of global warming. Just like Big Tobacco, Big Oil knew the truth long ago and peddled misinformation to con their customers and the American public." The company also names the then San Francisco City attorney Dennis Herrera because he accused fossil fuel companies of launching a disinformation campaign to deny and discredit the reality of global heating, and pledged to hold the companies responsible to account. In addition, ExxonMobil has targeted an environmental lawyer in Boston, Massachusetts, Matthew Pawa, who represents some of the California municipalities. The firm describes him as an outspoken advocate of misusing government power to limit free speech, and alleges that Matthew Pawa recruited the California cities and counties to sue ExxonMobil. The company claims those lawsuits are an affront to the First Amendment. Naomi Oreskes, a Harvard professor and co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, said ExxonMobil had a long history of attempting to bully its critics into silence. Naomi Oreskes said, "Now that the arguments have moved into the legal sphere, this feels to me like an extension of the sort of harassment, bullying, and intimidation that we've seen in the scientific sphere for the last two decades." Naomi Oreskes said that the legal strategy is also part of a broader public relations campaign to paint the company as a victim of radical environmentalists and opportunistic politicians, when ExxonMobil argues that it should be heralded for its efforts to combat the climate crisis. She said, "ExxonMobil has for a long time now tried to make themselves out to be the victim, as if somehow they're the innocent party here." The Texas Supreme Court is considering the case after a lower court backed Exxon's attempts to use Rule 202 against the California officials. The ruling was later overturned on appeal. The appeal court sympathized with ExxonMobil by acknowledging an impulse to safeguard an industry that is vital to Texas's economic well-being, and saying that lawfare is an ugly tool by which to seek the environmental policy changes pursued by California municipalities. But the appeal court said the defendants did not have sufficient direct connection to Texas for the case to be heard in the state. ExxonMobil has tried to head off climate litigation before, with lawsuits claiming that the attorney generals of Massachusetts and New York were violating the company's rights by investigating it. Those moves were blocked by the Massachusetts Supreme Court and by a federal court. If the Texas Supreme Court allows its Rule 202 bid to proceed, ExxonMobil might expect a more sympathetic hearing for its claims in a state court system that has shown deference to big oil. ExxonMobil is facing a barrage of other lawsuits across the United States. A number accuse the company and other fossil fuel firms of breaching consumer protection laws by propagating misinformation about climate science. Naomi Oreskes said ExxonMobil went further than most other oil companies in seeking to hide the evidence of its own scientists collected about global heating and in running a disinformation campaign. Naomi Oreskes said, "They're pushing their freedom of speech as an issue because more than any other company, it's been proven by people like me and others that they have a track record of promoting half-truths, misrepresentations, and in some cases, outright lies in the public sphere." Oreskes added, "This is so well documented that unless they can come up with some strategy to defend it, they're in potentially pretty serious trouble."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters, forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
There is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly. But if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way it is, politically, economically, etc., I don't think it'll be terribly difficult for them to push it through.
Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purza, London.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention in Israeli jails. The protest comes as hundreds of inmates have already boycotted Israel's military court, demanding an end to its illegal administrative detention. About 500 administrative detainees began the new year by refusing to show up for their court sessions.
Israeli regime has renewed administrative detention against hundreds of Palestinian inmates. Palestinians and human rights groups should do their best to put an end to the cruel policy. We stand by our brothers in Israeli jails who have boycotted Israel's military court. We also call on international human rights organizations to take a serious action.
The boycott of Israel's military court by Palestinian inmates comes as the health of the Palestinian hunger striker Nasser Abu Hamed is deteriorating. He has been in a coma for 11 days while in custody. Palestinian factions say the intentional medical negligence practiced by Israeli regime aims at killing the Palestinian prisoners.
Our message is clear. We will always support our detainees who stand against the brutal policies of the Israeli regime. Our brother Nasser Abu Hamed is in coma for 11 days due to medical negligence as Israel refuses to release him to provide him with proper medication. This amounts to a criminal act against our prisoners.
Public protests are mounting day by day against Israel's decision not to release Nasser Abu Hamed. Palestinians say they will hold Israel accountable if the inmate dies.
About 500 Palestinian detainees are refusing to show up for their court sessions, saying that this move is aimed at putting an end to the illegal Israeli administrative detention policy. They are also demanding the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Nasser Abu Hamed, who is on the verge of death. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates Parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a big confuse for everyone. So, and that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine-skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Genocide, the deliberate destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. There have been many, with death tolls in the millions, and the threat of another is always around the corner. Organizations like the IHRC are fighting to prevent that by raising awareness. The theme of this year's event, how do states sanitize genocide?
Genocide is sanitized. It's not only the genocidal state which actively attempts to sanitize its crimes. Other states are also actively involved. Those which supply the weapons and other instruments of annihilation. Those which refuse to acknowledge or call out the genocide for fear of the obligations to prevent and punish the crimes taking place that they would be placed under. Those which fear offending trading partners.
There are more than 1,500 monuments across London, commemorating everyone from controversial figures like Churchill to even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes. But you would be hard-pressed to find a monument that commemorated the 1 million people killed in the Great Irish Famine, a genocide orchestrated by the British.
The British government conveniently omits England's role in bringing about genocides like the so-called potato famine from school books, like many other regimes that weave history in a way that justifies crimes against humanity.
Here's a real chance for the UK government and the Department for Education to truly celebrate, or rather I should say commemorate, the diverse groups of people that it can encourage our systems and our schools to remember because of who their predecessor governments have exterminated in previous centuries, whether we're talking about the indigenous people of Australia, Malays, Chinese, Indian subcontinent, Iranians, Iraqis.
Genocide Memorial Day is held on the anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, which killed hundreds of Palestinians. Again in 2021, thousands of Palestinians were killed at the hands of the Israeli regime, which legitimizes its actions by evoking another genocide, the Holocaust. The vicious cycle continues, and therefore, so must the fight against dehumanization and ethnic cleansing. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel,
which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later,